In a world where most people watch movies and then forget about them, these brave heroes join forces to watch them again and then talk about them. Join them in their epic journey as they go back in time, a decade and beyond, to revisit and break down films from a vast array of genres. Do these movies hold up over time? Are they classics? Find out on Retro Movie Roundtable. Starring your hosts, Brian Fry, Chad Robinson, Destin Milbarnes, Lizzie Haynes, and Russell Guest. Coming now to headphones in your ears.
Welcome, all you lords, ladies, and knights of the Retro Movie Roundtable, where we watch movies and then talk about them. I'm your host, Destin Milbarnes, and joining me today is my good friend and co-host, Chad Robinson. What's cooking, good looking?
Congratulations on navigating the absolute minefield of misinformation in our outline tonight.
Of course, what Chad is referring to is that we like to have a little structure on the show, and we really leave it to our fearless leader, Russell, to put us some information together. And we were given everything wrong, which is a lot of fun for us to put together. What he did is he gave us a puzzle. Right? That's what he did. He said, figure this out. And so, yes, we're thankful for all the work that he does. And then when he gives us a puzzle, we have to say thank you. Thank you, Russell, the showrunner, for giving us this mess, which is what it was. But here we are about to record. But it's not just Chad and I. We have a return guest coming to you from right next to Chad. That's right. It's returning special guest Sarah Robinson. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. We haven't recorded together in a long time. This is going to be fun.
It's been a little bit.
Yeah.
And do we have a style? We have a rom-com style, you and I?
I think so, yes. That must be our thing.
And Chad, that's your thing too. You are the rom-com guy.
For sure.
That has been, it's such a weird pigeonhole I found myself in. Russell, it's like, hey, you like horror and you like chick flicks. These are the two things I'm going to put together. Horror often has final girls, so it's appropriate.
Final girls. I like that for our female protagonists, especially in a rom-com. Oh, that's final girl.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's do our warm-up questions, and we're not going to get into the warm-up questions that I would have been impossible for me to answer, which was specifically about one of our other hosts and her husband. Russell didn't include any information about my husband. That's okay. I'm not holding it against him.
We love you, Russell, but when you make a mistake and you're not here, we will make fun of you.
At least we don't have to hear about architecture tonight. Hey.
Oh, sir, you're so wrong. I have got some hay bale structures that need discussed.
I am looking forward to that. This is a great hay bale movie. You know, with your kids, there's got to be a movie that they love. But what is one that they love that you just don't enjoy yourself?
Oh, you're going to let me go first.
I think we have different levels of hatred. So,
the first thing I thought of, and I know Chad agrees with this one, is Cars 2. Our daughter loves Cars. And Cars 1 and Cars 3 are fine. Cars 2 is terrible.
It truly is. It's Pixar's worst film.
Well, what's wrong with Cars 2? I don't know very many things about Cars. I know that the guy says ka-chow.
They try to make it a spy movie with Cars, but
Mater is a spy. There are guns. Fails. It is like a wild ripoff of the series, but the original people did it.
It's terrible.
Are you able to convince your kids that Cars 2 isn't, like, should not be picked?
She leans towards Cars 3, which is fine.
Yeah. Cars 3, they made up for themselves, but...
Yeah, yeah. Cars 2 is lowest in the rotation, so we've won that battle a little bit. She at least acknowledges this is the worst of the trilogy.
That's good to know that you've got a little bit of taste brewing with your progeny.
And I did think of Cars 2, but what drives me nuts... So Air Bud, which I still want to do on this podcast, I have been campaigning for this. Please, for the love of God, somebody shortlist Air Bud. I will pick it. I promise you if I'm on it. But if you're unaware, because you don't have children or just unaware of this phenomena, there are spinoffs of Air Bud, and they get progressively worse, where they become puppies. And then these puppies talk. And they have, they're called the Buddies films. And the bane of my existence is Super Buddies. And the dogs, like, they're a worse version of Paw Patrol. They get superpowers. And they make corny puns throughout the entire thing. And they save really no one from no giant crisis whatsoever. Hmm. Superpowers aren't needed. It's awful.
Yeah, and I think half of the dogs that they used to film the Super Buddies actually survived, which is incredible. I mean, but from what I understand, all of those other Air Buddies, they do go to heaven.
God. Oh, this is like some Ben-Hur level. Yes, the horses survived.
Well, this was a great question for me, of course, because I do not have children. So I had to, right? I had to put this into, how do I answer this question? Well, what's a movie that some children love? Well, I think this is a movie that a lot of children loved, and they hold it dear to their hearts nowadays as they've grown up. I don't enjoy The Goonies, and I never have.
Oh, you say die.
And I don't think it's very good. And so when people like have that kind of nostalgic, oh, this was like the movie when I was a kid, The Goonies, I'm just like, that's a hard pass. And I think the people that like it have been tricked somehow.
You know what? Somehow. If you were saying the name Hocus Pocus, I would be right there with you.
You know, I kind of share that mentality too. I also don't think The Sandlot is that great, though I think it's better than The Goonies. And then the other one that falls into that, like, oh, what do kids grow up with, like, in their family, especially around the holidays? The worst Christmas movie is A Christmas Story.
Oh, no. I'm getting off this wild ride. This is not working out.
But inside baseball, a lot of times when I record, I'm looking at my outline or looking at info, but I made sure to focus the video on both Chad and Sarah so that I could see their reactions to what I would say, and they were both shaking their heads at me.
Sarah likes A Christmas Story less than me.
I do like it, though.
Yeah.
Although, yeah. Well, never mind. We won't go there. Last time Sarah watched it.
Yeah.
Oh, what happened the last time you watched it? We can't never mind it. We can't never mind it here. This is our wild intro.
My daughter is a very sensitive soul. And so the scene at the restaurant, the Chinese restaurant, where they bring out the duck. And... Oh. Like, it still has the head.
It looks like a duck.
And we're like, it is a duck. And the person, the lady's like, no problem. Chops the head off the duck. My daughter, we're laughing because it's a funny scene. My daughter is in tears crying. We're like, the duck was already dead. But because it still looked like a duck, it had been mutilated. And this was not a cause for laughter. She was bawling, which honestly, as a bad parent, that made it so much funnier to me.
Representing bad parents. Yeah. No. Now, hopefully she gets turned off from that movie and doesn't want to come back to it.
Because she is firmly on what you are putting down right now.
All right.
Like, so, this is an overrated movie and I don't get it.
She's got taste and she's smart. Sarah, what's the last movie you saw?
I was trying to remember. I think it was watching WALL-E with our daughter because she had seen a bunch of WALL-E stuff and she wanted to see it. So I watched it with her.
Eva. Yeah, incredible. I think that is a top five. Is it a Pixar? It's a Pixar movie?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's a top five Pixar for me. I like that there are other WALL-A's or WALL-S's, big ones up in the space station.
Yeah.
Like, that's very cool to me. There need to be wall X's and wall Y's, wall B's. I'm just talking about Star Wars fighter pilots now. What's the last movie you saw, Chad?
Well, on the other spectrum, I watched an indie werewolf movie called Wolf Hollow. And I genuinely think that's doing horror movies on hard mode. Like, making a good werewolf movie is hard to do. Hmm. And it's even harder to do on a shoestring budget. This, I will say, had some good ideas. It's filmed in Pennsylvania. If you have a high tolerance for, like, well, they tried. Imagine if they had a much bigger budget. This is probably a movie that's worth checking out. You just have to go in with the understanding they have no money. They're doing what they can. They're pulling people off the street and saying, hey, come act in my movie. So Some of the stuff was cool.
Yeah, I want more. I don't know if it's Wolfman or Werewolf. I don't know which one I want more of. But I do think that they have been attempting to kind of revitalize the Universal Monsters verse.
Yes.
And I think maybe that is something they would be able to pump some money in as far as the Wolfman. But we would see where that goes. I would watch that one. I would watch that one if it came out. But the most recent Invisible Man was very, very good.
It has to be better than the Benicio del Toro, one. That one was no bueno.
Well, speaking of bueno, I actually did watch something that I thought was pretty fun. From 1994, I watched Michelle Yao in Wing Chun. So this is an early, this is not, I guess I can't say early, but, you know, mid-90s, Hong Kong-based. We have the Chinese movies produced over there are pretty far behind as far as our, like, camera qualities and our picture quality. But and they're still holding on to some of the old kung fu tropes. But that movie was pretty fun. She is so talented as a martial artist. And I think I've seen her in a lot more recently that focus on her being an actor. But this is really more about her being a martial artist. And it's great. And it also includes a young Donnie Yen, we all know from Ip Man. And then he played a fan favorite character in the recent John Wick 4. Gosh, what was it? The Star Wars flick.
Yeah, I was going to say Rogue One, man.
Yeah, yeah, and he's great in Rogue One, too. Young Donnie Yen plays a character. Normally, you would expect him to be like the master or someone who is infallible or undefeatable, but he's a real funny young martial artist. But we're not doing Pixar. We're not doing martial arts. What are we covering tonight, Chad?
We are doing a werewolf movie. No. Although.
The outline.
It's a great title if it was.
It happened one night. And sadly, not a werewolf movie from 1934.
Yeah, it'd be an awesome werewolf title, but this is not a werewolf movie. Yes, right, from 1934, starring Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. A budget of $325,000, and it grossed $2.5 million globally. This was the number one movie of 1934. Right behind it was Viva Villa, which is something I'd never heard of before. IMDb gives this 8.1, and from Rotten Tomatoes, our aggregator here, critics' tomato meter 98% fresh, and the audience scores 93% fresh. That's very, very good. This, at the Academy Awards, the seventh ever, it won 5, including Outstanding Production, Best Director for Frank Capra, Best Actor, Clark Gable, Best Actress, Claudette Colbert, and Best Adaptation for Robert Riskin. Many of those AFI distinctions, they've redone the AFI so many times, so it falls different places on the list. But its highest is in the 2008 version, Top 10 Romantic Comedies. This is number 3. That's high praise. Now, Sarah, had you ever seen It Happened One Night?
No, I had not. No.
What had led you to say, huh, let's hit 30s rom-com?
Well, Chad was trying to convince me to come on the podcast.
Okay,
and
yeah.
He
a mistake,
said,
yes.
He said there's this older rom-com that's supposed to be really good, and it would make Russell happy, and I liked a brown nose, so I put it on shortlist.
Well, here were the parameters we were given. Select an Oscar-nominated or Oscar-winning movie. And with Sarah, that's either going to be romantic comedy or animation.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yes, it tracks.
So there were some options. Jerry Maguire was an option. Yeah. I had never seen that. Yeah. When this one was picked, immediately had to watch Jerry Maguire. Great movie, by the way.
So this would have been your first time, Sarah. Were there any expectations for this?
Well, I was hoping he forced me into something. No, I always like to watch a new movie that I've heard is good, but I didn't know what to expect out of a 1930s good. So I don't know what my expectations were.
Mild misogyny.
Yeah, there you go.
I had a little bit of that same thing. I had a little bit of that same thing. Is that what am I supposed to expect from a 1930s?
I didn't really know what to expect.
Supposedly good. Yeah. So Chad, was this your first time as well?
It was. Yeah, I don't know what to do with the 1930s. When I watch a 1930s movie, it's a horror film. It's this is like the prime time of the Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
This is when we do things. So this is a very different, I had a lot of concerns coming in. And especially when it's high up, Dustin, you're the same way. Like AFI has these lists and they may as well not.
Yeah.
Like they're not worth the paper they're written on. So.
Well, for me, it's also my first time viewing. And I think the only expectation I could have had was knowing that Clark Gable's in it. And that's kind of it. And yeah. And though I know that, I mean, this is a 90-year-old movie here. So at this point, it's like, well, do I even know anything about Clark Gable at all? And I don't think so.
I've never seen one of his movies.
I mean, I'm showing some ignorance here, but was he in Gone with the Wind? Was he Rhett Butler?
I don't
literally
know.
Like it's 90 years ago. It's forgivable if we don't know, right? So this is something where I'm like, well, okay, this guy was a real big deal back then. So I suppose this has to be driven by him. And then I'm also thinking like, well, maybe because he's such a famous star and he's such a leading man that he has to be like irresistible on screen.
It was Clark Gable in Gone with the Wind. Yes.
So at least I got
screaming
something
at us right now.
So I'm thinking like, well, this guy must be so bombastic on screen. There must be only one way to present him for audiences. And I'm going to say, I think this movie really subverted those expectations for me as to what kind of lead he was going to be. But I also, like I said, I don't know anything about the guy. Sarah, did you enjoy it?
I did. At first I'm like, well, this is starting out a little slow, but by the end I was enjoying myself. And
she
I always
off a boat right off the bat.
Well, yeah, but then the bus ride was a little long sometimes.
yeah, as they are.
But no, I enjoyed myself. I like a good love story. That's why I like rom-coms. So, and it fit that bill for sure.
I think that's kind of the loving embrace of the rom-com is that you are expecting to get taken care of. The movie's going to wrap its arms around you in some way. No matter how it tries to zag you, you can kind of expect that. And if you don't get it, then that must have been a point of the movie anyway. So in this case, I kind of got that. Did you enjoy this one, Chad?
Yeah, I had a surprisingly good time. 1930s humor is so wildly different than 2024 humor. So I certainly didn't expect to find myself laughing, but I did. I found myself laughing several times throughout this film.
I did too. And we will get into that because we are going to talk more detailed about It Happened One Night from 1934, but we're not going to do it yet. Folks, if you have not watched this movie, now would be the time to go and turn us off and watch this movie from 1934, because after this ad break, Chad is going to reveal the plot. So we'll see you on the other side.
Welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast.
I'm Bill.
And I'm Jason. And this is the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. So whether you're a brain, a jock, a valley girl, or a Jedi, we've got some 80s classics for you.
Do these movies stand the test of time? Are we discovering something new? Is there an 80s movie we're finally watching for the first time?
Join us each week as we dive into the cinematic nostalgia that inspired and influenced a generation. From the hits to the cult classics, we'll discuss our earliest memories, favorite scenes, fun facts, and our not-so-favorite movie moments, too.
It's the All 80s Movies Podcast, now available on all major streaming platforms. Please subscribe and happy listening.
And we are back. It is time for us to reveal the plot of 1934's It Happened One Night. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. But Chad, take it away.
Spoiled heiress Ellie Andrews has eloped with a fortune hunter and pilot named by the name of King Wesley, who is not a king. That's a weird name for him. Her father wants the marriage annulled because he believes King is only interested in Ellie's wealth. Ellie jumps ship and begins a journey to New York City to reunite with Wesley. Down on his luck, newspaper journalist Peter Warren recognizes Ellie and gives her a deal. He'll help her get to New York if she gives him the exclusive story, and she agrees. Mayhem ensues with bus breakdowns, hitchhiking, and near robberies. As Peter and Ellie go through this journey, they grow fonder and fonder of each other. Peter sneaks out one night to get money to marry Ellie, but she wakes up and assumes Peter has left her. She agrees to a second formal wedding with Wesley. Peter is confronted by Ellie's father after trying to get reimbursement for his road expenses. Ellie's father gets Peter to declare his love for Ellie openly, and then convinces Ellie to leave Wesley at the altar. The two lovebirds reunite and get married after Ellie and Wesley's marriage is annulled.
We do start on a boat. We start with her jumping off of it. I got to tell you guys, I had to rewatch the first 30 seconds of this movie because I was like, wait, whoa, whoa, this is important info. They are shooting us some very important info about her situation right now. Hunger strike because the dad does not support the secret marriage. So what we're given here is this explanation of why she's unhappy and dad is extremely overbearing, who we can say now on this half of the show that, you know, he does redeem himself later, but we're given this kind of, oh, she's grown up spoiled or she's grown up protected. Sarah, is this a character that you were given a chance to root for after amount of time, or does this fit into that sort of, it did start off slow as in like, how am I supposed to connect with Ellie here?
I did find it a little weird that she was the spoiled brat. And in that opening scene on the boat, it was abundantly clear that she was.
Yeah.
But then once she was on the bus, you could kind of not see a different, I guess, see a different side a little bit. Like you, she was still being spoiled. She wanted to use her money for everything,
mm-hmm.
but she was still going to scrap and scrape to get by no matter what she had to do to get to Wesley, who she thought she needed to get to. So there's some determinedness about that, and I would not think of that as a spoiled brat at that point. So
she does give that lovely speech when she's lost her suitcase of how Peter doesn't know what it's like to be controlled or
right.
or be in this environment and how it can be different. It's a different side of the coin, but it's still hard.
Right.
It made me think that she would say she's going to starve her way to New York. But it also, I think she reveals herself that she probably wouldn't last very long with no money. Like the scrape her way by is something that maybe she said to herself to make it, Chad. But I don't know if she was really capable too much without any money to be able to streetwise her way even across town.
Oh, it backfires immediately when she tells the bus driver, hey, I'm going to go walk to this hotel, wait for me. And you get the great, oh, yeah. And she's just commanding him, yeah. And then comes back, where's the bus?
Right.
I think that was the moment that I realized she's trying to be anonymous. She's trying to not be known. You know, and so she immediately reaps what she sows. Like, oh, the bus is not going to wait for her. So that I think that was kind of a little awakening. But we do eventually get to getting to know her a little bit better. So Sarah, if you believe she has any charm, I'm taking a leap here that she's likable. How do you feel about eventually? I mean, she's not dull. She's not dim-witted. She's got some quickness to her in her back and forth with Peter. But about when does she become a character that you root for? If, and I might be going too far, you might not really root for her.
I don't know what the pivotal point was. I think it was more when she realized she had no other choice but to depend on him, Peter. And so maybe after they had lost the bus and they were along the roads, I don't know. It was hard to root for her for a long time. There's a quality about trying to scrape by. She wanted to do that, but I don't know.
It's like she read a fairy tale about somebody being streetwise and thought she could do it. And I think maybe she's taught that lesson early, that she kind of needs to lean on this stranger on the bus before he reveals.
She found that guy.
Kind of lucky. Yeah.
Although she finds out that she could get a fleet of cars by taking off all of her clothes.
That's right. That's pretty late. That's like an hour 10 in.
Yeah.
But that's a great transformation of, okay, I'm willing to debase myself a little bit with this vagabond and get us a ride.
Real 1930s risque showing that kneecap.
Oh, she didn't want to do it. They brought in a body double.
No way.
She said it was unladylike, but they brought in a body double and she flipped out. So, yeah, Colbert said, "That's not my leg. Get this showgirl out of there. I'll do it." So, yeah,
wow.
That's one way. Okay, you're not going to do it. We'll go get a dancer. She'll show some leg.
So it does. She holds on to that prim and properness a bit. So, we don't really get to see her emerge out of the shell too much. Then again, it might just be that she is completely dependent on Peter at this point to somehow make it, not just because he's the only one that's got any cash left, but also just because, she's kind of oblivious to her own bag being taken. We get a little moment where she describes, like, how did you spend your day? I ran in between doorways just not get wet in the rain. So it's like really quickly everything gets taken away, and somehow they have to make it. But speaking of that prim and properness, we also have kind of a respect for it in a way. Sarah, tell me a little bit about were you surprised at Peter's character being so willing to, like, put up the curtain, we'll call it the Walls of Jericho, right? Yes. To put the Walls of Jericho up and to be about as respectful as you could possibly be. This kind of threw me for a loop.
I think he had to be that way a little bit because he was trying to get the story to get his, continue his profession. Like, he was down on his luck as well. He needed a story to break loose. So if he wasn't going to respect her in a way to be able to get the story that he needed, he wasn't going to be able to get it. Also, I married somebody that was, I could see him putting up Walls of Jericho while we were dating. So it's not something I haven't seen before.
That's so sweet.
That's right. 90 years later, there are still men out there that will respect you. But yeah, we see it with Peter twice, actually, where he's a good guy, independent of self-interest. When he goes and chases down the briefcase, he doesn't know who she is. He's just, here's a mugger, I'm going to chase him down. Now, he doesn't get the bag back, but there's no real rhyme or reason to doing it. And then the kid that's needing money on the bus, and he just gives him the $10, and that's it. That's all they have.
Did he give it to him,
right,
or did she?
Well, he pulled it out.
But she just handed.
He was putting it back. Sarah's right here. He was about to put it back. I think he realized he didn't have change. He probably could have kicked him over two bits, and instead he was like, "All I got is a 10." And she just, to her, that's nothing, I guess. Right. I was like, oh, here you go. He also kind of. I guess this might not fall into the same selfless category, but with our annoying guy on the bus that's Shapley. Also with him, Mr. Shapley, Mr. Fun on the Side Shapley, he does kind of stand in. And I think we've seen this a lot in rom-coms since then, is guy who steps up to get the girl away from the worst guy with a creative lie. I think we've had that's my wife you're talking to. We've had that happen before, or I guess we should say we've had that happen since. And so he does kind of look out for her in this way. So Chad, with him kind of attaching himself because he needs the story, I didn't find myself rooting for him to get the story. I really quickly fell into, I'm into them falling in love. And that's kind of what we get.
I loved his editor, though. Like, that dude just, he's an emotional roller coaster. High, low, calling everyone, tense, panic, and just hates Peter, loves Peter. You're the best. I hate you. Strangle him. And then he keeps getting, I love the collect, which is a relic that nobody knows. I had no idea that you could send a telegram collect, by the way. That was news to me.
Yep, only thought you could phone someone collect.
Right?
Yeah, but that administrative assistant, secretary, whatever, keeps taking them collect. He's like, you take it, collect one more time. You're fired. So I did like that dynamic. I liked his work dynamic. I thought it was pretty funny. I don't know what $1,000 in 1934 equates to today, but that seems kind of wild to go up to your boss and be like, hey, there's a girl I want to marry. Can you just hand me $1,000? Just help me.
And yeah.
The guy's on board with it too. So that tells me everyone here is, they've got the right heart. It may be misplaced sometimes. Like, I didn't necessarily like, and this is clearly 1930s speech, when Peter has his interaction with her dad. And he's going through and indicating that Ellie drives him nuts, and that's fine. But he's like, she deserves somebody that would sock her once a day, whether she had it coming or not. And the dad's like, this is the person for my daughter. And, you know, if that happens today, if somebody comes to me years from now when my daughter's old enough and says, your daughter drives me crazy, she deserves somebody that will hit her, whether she deserves it or not, I'd be like, please get out of my house immediately before I go polish a gun.
Right. And for the time, there is something to be said about how when they put on that little drama in the cabin, the first cabin they stay at, the auto camp, the detectives barge in and say, who are you? And they're putting on this scene that she is, I think this is the first time we see her capable, at least holding her own as far as wits. Like, I know to play along with this. I think that's the first time we see that. And that's where I kind of leaned forward in my seat, like, oh, this is going to be fun. This isn't going to be just her being drug along by our hero. It's she's going to play a role in this too, which maybe didn't pan out quite as much. But that he's really shouting at her, and she's just, you know, sobbing. And everyone is just kind of like, this is okay. It's like, no.
More than that, like, the innkeeper leaves and he says, see, they're a nice married couple.
Yeah. Right. Par for the course, apparently.
Was that the 1930s equivalent of Clark Kent spit curl and glasses? Like, he just mildly messes up her hair and unbuttons one button on her blouse, and suddenly she's a completely different person. It's like, she looks the same. She looks like she got out of bed and missed a button, but otherwise I would clearly know this is Ellie Andrews.
Yeah, I guess it was a little bit of we instantly had whoever got hold of a newspaper was able to see, like, oh, that's her, you know. Shapley sees it right away, and he does get intimidated by our Peter out on the side of the road after he, you know, kind of successfully lets him know that he's in on what's going on. Did you find that implausible that they would be able to make it at all? Or were you just kind of along for the ride? Like, here's all of these nice little vignettes, and each one is charming in its own way. The reason I ask, because I found myself not really worried about whether or not she's going to get back to King. It was more of just like, I'm now fully invested in these fun little vignettes, these romps.
Yeah, I think I agree. I don't ever doubted she would make it. It was just a matter of how. You were talking about Shapley and being intimidated, and that was the one scene that I didn't like it. I felt like he went a little extra that Peter did to try and get Shapley to go away. I understand that he was trying to be greedy and get money, but I just felt like he was threatening his children.
Right.
Like,
gangsters
really,
are going to come like, and murder your children.
Like, is there, he really going to cause you that much trouble in your journey to get through that you have to threaten him? Like, I don't know. It was a little far-fetched for
me. It was over the top. It was really over the top.
This movie reminded me, like, the movie that came to mind was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Like, just the different methods of traveling that they wind up. It's almost like a rat race, too. They're stealing cars. They're on trains. She starts on a boat. Like, everything they can to get to their destination. And to your point, I was never concerned that anything was going to truly go awry and keep them from that destination. I was just enjoying the vignettes of, okay, here's, even though we get two different bus scenes, they're different, they're distinct, they're a ton of fun. I told Sarah, like, I had no idea there were verses to Man on the Flying Trapeze. None. And yeah, apparently there are at least three, and that they were well known enough for everyone on that bus to know them and sing them.
I don't know that everyone knew them, because one of the verses, the guy goes, I know this verse.
Yeah.
Like, other people don't.
Well, that's fine, but I had this discussion with Sarah, like, what is that song in modern era where you could stand up on a bus and start singing and people are going to know not just the chorus, but three verses of it?
Should have got them apple bottom jeans.
Yeah, no. The closest thing I can think of is like Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. Like, that's going to be close.
Boots with the fur. Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I get what you're saying. And for a second there, I was thinking that you don't have to know the real words. You can, it's just insert this joke or this parable or this story along to the melody of the song, to where anybody could stand up and say, okay, I got this one. And then it's like, what limerick do you know? And you put it along to the music. I don't know if that's the case, but
man,
I think
you know far more clever people than I do in the general public. I do not trust the general public to be this clever.
I think you had to be cleverer back then, because
Alaska.
Yeah, that really was a riot to everybody on the bus.
Yes.
Well, and that was another thing about, like, speaking of the vignettes, and this is one of the second or third bus scene, where you kind of get like 3 minutes of singing and 3 minutes of sort of joy. And it's like, oh, this is just like movies needed a musical number because it's just pleasant. And our audience like almost expects it. Like, here's something pleasant happening. But it is kind of two things in a row. I think we have the first night in the cabin where they do reach kind of a mutual understanding. She wakes up in a great mood to see her dress has been pressed and to see that he's cooking breakfast. And this is where I think we get a little bit of a turn from, oh, Peter is not a scoundrel. He's not some streetwise urchin, Chad. He is streetwise in that way, but he's also, he's someone that is capable enough. And I think he proves that he's capable of getting them from A to B, but also capable of being like a partner.
Oh yeah. He's going to teach her how to dunk.
That's right. You can, if you're going to delay in the coffee, then it's going to get too soggy and fall apart. Did you find our Peter as someone that the ladies would have stars in their eyes for, Sarah? Did he eventually become kind of an upstanding guy that you can see any lady of the time falling for?
I don't know about any lady of the time, but
she has a weird thing where she does not like arrogance, and this dude,
he does have some
reeks of arrogance
about him. But there are those scenes where he takes care of her, and it may be in little ways. It may be pressing her dress. It may be finding her a carrot, even if she refuses it. But
stopping her from wasting money on a box of chocolates.
Right. Yeah. There you go. And you
them's fighting words, though.
It's also a little bit on the controlling side, like, how dare you?
Right, right. But, I mean, he's trying to make sure that she makes it. And, you know, it's not just about his story. I think that is a driver for him, but he also realizes that she's worthy of that and those little things to help her feel comfortable. And the walls of Jericho are part of that as well, you know, give her that respect, which is a big thing.
Yeah, and I think that was something that was unexpected from me, is that he would stay with that mindset. I think I lost the drive for the story, and I had instead like adopted a drive for them being together. Like that I liked. It's funny, the first thing just came to my head is like Homeward Bound. Like, these three have to stay together. And for me, these two have to stay together. We haven't covered that on the show. Maybe that needs to come up.
No, I do not feel like crying to the tune of Animals.
If you're going to get Air Bud on the short list, then Homeward Bound has to be on the same short list.
I'm not picking it. I don't want to cry.
Well,
Shadow Chan. Like Shadow coming last. Oh, man. Tears.
Well, eventually we get to when she asks Peter if he's ever thought about settling down with a girl. Don't tell me you haven't thought about it. And that's when he begins to reveal a little bit about himself. Is that the first time that he reveals anything about his wants or like his dreams out loud? Is that late in the movie, like an hour 25 in?
What works for her. I mean, she winds up in tears and going around the walls of Jericho, sans trumpet, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, oh, I love you. Yeah, that was a nice, tender moment between the two of them.
Where the emotion that she on her face as she comes across, because she doesn't break the walls down. She just sheepishly comes around the other side. And that was really a moment of, oh, look how his words have made her so vulnerable. And because he was saying, this is what I want, talking about becoming one with the water and having the stars so close above that you could stir them up. I mean, we hear lines like that in old romantic movies all the time. You know, you want me to get you the moon? I'll wrap a lasso around it. You know, that kind of thing. And I think generally we get a very specific type of reaction when the poetic hero says something. But I got to say that in a movie that is very lighthearted, that I thought the way that she came around that curtain was really dramatic. And so then, you know, we see her say, I love you. I want to go with you. And his response, it really, really kind of broke my, in that moment, his response really kind of broke my heart.
Yeah, go back to bed.
Yeah. And that's when you are probably reminded, oh, yeah, he is doing this for his story and his job.
It's Lady and the Tramp. he is the tramp, and he's like, yeah, we don't belong together. We're different worlds. I did like the sincerity of that scene, though, because before you get questions of, hey, who are you? And he responds with that weird poetry of, I'm the whippoorwill.
Right.
What a strange thing to say. And then finally gives his name.
Well, you got a name, don't you?
Gives his name, and then she immediately responds with, I don't like it.
Well, I love that humor, too.
Yeah, yeah. And then he says, well, you'll be giving it back in the morning, because he's signed her up as Mrs. Warren.
Oh, see, I read that differently. The way that it wasn't about the Mrs. Warren that he's giving back. It's the way that I read it was she doesn't like his name, but it's in the morning. It's the next day that he gets her to New York that he can redeem his name and get his job back.
Oh yeah. I just took it as he's registered under a false name and you can go back to being yourself. But I kind of like the arrogance of what you're saying, like the boldness.
Yeah. Yeah. You're giving me back my name. Well, you know, there was a lot of wit in that moment. And Sarah, a lot of humor. Did you find yourself like Chad laughing out loud in this movie?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I...
Well, some of the stuff is just, oh, that's clever, and you get a smirk on your face.
Right. But there was probably the one thing that confused me the most, and we're going back, is when he starts undressing in the Walls of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he's talking about the order, and he's talking about the order of the clothes, and then he says, most people would do the pants next, but I'm going to do the shoes. And all I can think about is, how are you getting your pants off if you don't have your shoes off?
Yeah, I am nearly 40 years old, and I just now learned that I am in the minority by taking my pants off after I take my shoes off. Like, Dustin, are you in this rare minority?
Strangely enough, I'm one of those freaks that takes their shoes off before they take their pants off. Right.
He's like, this is what makes me different than most men. What was going on in the 30s that you removed your pants prior to your shoes?
And I feel like that was where I was giggling the most. I don't know why, but...
Because you're imagining a grown man attempting to take pants off while still wearing shoes and it not working.
Right? That and I kept yelling at her to eat her carrot, and she wouldn't eat her carrot. And I didn't understand why she was so stubborn about not eating her carrot until she finally said she didn't like carrots. But that took like 20 minutes, and that really bothered me.
I was taking it as a, I can't eat a raw carrot because I'm falling into that spoiled. I would only have something prepared, cooked, or you know, put over a carrot fondue with cinnamon and sugar, you know, like the ways that you can really zhuzh up a carrot. But yeah, she, you know, she eventually has to eat something. And that is, you know, we were talking a little bit about like the vulnerability of coming around the sheet earlier, after he carries her across the creek, which, you know, he's just, I guess he's doing the right thing. I don't know if he's doing this like, oh, this is going to be sweet. It's just like, okay, now we're at this creek. I suppose I'm going to be the one that has to roll up my pants cuffs and take my shoes off here, hold this and carry her across. But it's after that that we have the hay bale night scene, which is another place that like our emotions are allowed to come out and their emotions are allowed to come out, specifically the fear. Was that an impactful scene with to realize just how much she is depending on him?
Oh, we got to address the piggybacking debate, though.
Let's do that first.
He's clearly just over the shoulder carrying her.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever she's had in her life, I am full Peter Warren. Like, you have not had any piggybacking. This is Abraham Lincoln. Now, there's a piggybacker.
There's a piggybacker.
Yes. He's a natural born piggybacker. I enjoyed that banter, but it was interesting that she did not have any experience of what an actual piggyback ride was. That's something that every child grows up knowing. So it tells you her childhood's a little different. Someone's just throwing her over the shoulder, walking away. But those were very convenient. There was a lot of convenient hay. I assume we're in, like this said at one point, 4 hours from New York. I assume we're in like rural Pennsylvania, but still, it's wild that in the 30s you can just drive up to someone's property, mess up their hay, and sleep in it, and no one's going to murder you. Like my movies, that does not happen. If you attempt that,
you normally watch,
there's a dude with a pitchfork, and that pitchfork goes through you.
They didn't have a choice.
They did. You could knock on somebody's door or whatever and be like, hey, I'm a hobo, because we see that with the train. It's like, hey, I'm a hobo, can I go sleep in your hay? They're probably gonna be like, sure, whatever.
I feel like our director made the decision to not have them kiss in the hay, to have them get close,
so close.
And I liked that delay. I liked being led a little bit further, like, oh, this is not just convenient. That this is something that you might not get. I mean, it's the 30s. I'm still thinking to myself, they're going to end up happy together somehow. But then you're reminded of some of the things, of the immeasurable wealth that her banker dad has. And you're reminded of all the resources at his disposal. And you're reminded of the king, who is... just a bore, a just useless character.
But he's a pilot.
But he's a pilot. So, hey, so we got an airplane copter whirly gig scene in there for some reason.
They built it and it had to be used. It was for some other movie. And they're just like, what do we do with this thing on our lot? Well, we'll make King a pilot. Shouldn't we change his name to not be King? Nah, it's fine.
He'll be okay. Yeah. So, yeah, we get the choice to, like, delay it. And then we get back to Dad kind of, I'm going to say, redeeming himself a bit at the end. Sarah, did you think that this character had a real 180 in our audience's minds?
I certainly think he had some kind of change, because in the beginning they seemed to hate each other. Like, it was more than just a disagreement.
He was tired of her stuff.
Yeah, and I think she was tired of his. And for him to then suddenly, once she gets to New York and she's about ready to marry King Wesley, he's like having this tender moment with her and trying to determine if this is really what she wants, but not in the like type of way that he was on the boat. On the boat, it was just, you're not doing this.
Yeah, there's my no way choice. Or the highway.
Whereas back out in New York, it was, well, you have this choice. Are you really sure this is the choice you want to make? And allowing her to still make the mistake if she chooses to do so. And the fact that you really only see him, I mean, you do see him periodically between times, but
yeah, yelling at people to go faster.
Those are the big scenes that you see him. It just seems like it was two different people almost. And, I don't know why, really, but...
See, I kind of took it as father's intuition. Like, he's dislikable, and you don't know why, but he knows who King Wesley is, and King Wesley is a gold digger. It's like, he's not marrying Ellie because he loves her. He's marrying Ellie because he wants money. And he winds up being justified in that because King Wesley is not Prince. Stupid titles, why? Why are we doing this?
His first name should have been Ace.
Right. Yeah, that's fine. Or Pilot, if we're just going by titles. Pilot Wesley. He's like, I'm going to write him a check for $100,000 and he'll go away happy. And sure enough, yep, he does. Like, we never hear from him again. So he's justifying that. And he does have that sweet moment of trying to get Peter. He keeps antagonizing him. You're not answering my question. That's not an answer. That's not a response. That's an evasion of, tell me you love my daughter. And that was, I think it's the first time he hasn't been used for his money. Because he just seems so taken aback by Peter, just basically saying, your daughter's a nuisance and I just want reimbursed for my road expenses.
Which I thought was lovely. Now, this is it where you said that father's intuition, right? Is that he is consistent. He doesn't like King Wesley. That's the same from the beginning, super unlikable version of Pops, absolutely, to the end. And then, but he's in this moment where, you know, she's wearing the same dress for most of the movie. Then finally, she's in this sort of elegant gown, and we're revealed this moment where he's coming in to talk to her, and he really is much more tender. And trying to understand, the consistency is still there. Like, hey, I understand if you want to call this off, but he does recognize that there's something that she wants. And maybe he was too blinded. We don't know anything about their past relationship. We start off with him locking her up on a boat. So it is hard to be like, well, what ounce of tenderness exists there? But what he does want is what's right for his daughter. And so he goes about it the wrong way in the beginning, and then he goes about it the right way by listening to her, or at least trying to get the right info out of her, and he gets the name. And then am I not giving the 30s enough credit for a twist that he recognizes the name because there's a telegram or a letter typed and signed by Peter that says, I want to talk about something financial. and that is what Ellie sees, it's almost like, wow, this is a great twist to be like, oh, all of the things that I might have fallen in love with was all a lie.
All a fake.
The only thing that mattered was that he got me to New York so that he could collect the money. And then I must have missed this. I must have got distracted by something, but I didn't know that he was unaware of a $10,000 reward. Did you guys know that?
Yeah.
That he was unaware of it, but apparently everybody else knew about it.
Yeah, Shapley reads the paper. Peter never reads the paper.
That's it.
He's mad at it.
Oh, that's too good. He's mad at the paper, so he doesn't read it. That's too good. But yeah, so all he comes in is he wants just his travel expenses. That doggedness in Dad to say, do you love her? That's an evasion. Do you love her? He asks three, maybe four times, and he gets the answer. I love that the way that it resolved was, you know, in part due to his meddling for the right reasons. I just think that tenderness, among all of the fun little vignettes we get, this movie reminds you it's romantic. This movie reminds you that it is about the romance at its heart. I think we were really rewarded. Now, as far as like our atmosphere for this movie, yeah, you know, I think you nailed it, Chad, with the planes, trains, and automobile. But is there anything about like the timing or just the era that is, we'll say, either romantic or just like nostalgic for you? Like, oh, I like movies during this time with steam engines and people, you know, manually calling out for trains.
That dude who has the world's most dangerous job at the railroad crossing, he's standing basically right up against the train to keep people from dying.
Yeah. Driving the sleekest Model Ts. You know, I love that old ad for Model Ts. You can have it in any color you want as long as it's black.
Yes. Yeah, what's romantic to me, I think, is the little things that people wouldn't bother with nowadays. So Peter is going to these cottages and he's saying Mr. and Mrs. Warren, and the implication that we may not pick up on today is it would have been a moral issue. Mm-hmm. If he was just there with some young woman who wasn't his wife. And so there's some degree of romanticism of, okay, these are little couples retreats. These are things for married couples, and the innkeepers and whomever are just, they're there for whatever weird whims you have. Like, okay, nowadays, if you go to a hotel and you say, hey, clerk, I need you to get me a sheet, a rope, and a trumpet, they're going to say, I don't know what kinky stuff you're into, but none of that is going to happen. I don't know. Dustin, you've worked as a concierge. If somebody calls you for a rope, a bed sheet, and a trumpet, are you getting any of those? Maybe a bed sheet. But
I say, get real.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So go back to your room. Leave me alone. I'll send you a complimentary bottle of champagne.
There's a charm there in those little cottages and inns where they are just like rooting for married couples, whatever the circumstance, however weird. They're just like, young love, yay, we're going to cheer it on.
Yeah. I think it does kind of drive me crazy to think about how nice that cabin is and how expensive that would be.
$2.
It'd be more expensive than a hotel room to get a quaint little cabin like that nowadays.
Oh, 100%. $2 a night.
No, I love that. And, you know, we've got our, you know, everything communicated via newspaper. Yeah, we do have a telegram being sent. We've got, I think the real funny thing at the very beginning, I couldn't quite get the clamber of it, but when Peter's on that heated phone call in the phone booth and everyone's like around him,
yes,
like cheering him on or something. Are those his buddies or are these just like dudes on the street that like their entertainment is hearing an upset phone call? I didn't understand it.
I assume they were like drinking bar buddies, things like that. So they clearly knew this guy complains about his job or whatever. And so he's telling off his boss, even though he's really not.
And they're in Miami. but it certainly doesn't feel like it. They're really, this movie is really about all the places on the road they are, Sarah. Is that something where you're comfortable just it being a travel movie that we're never in one spot for very long? A lot of the movies we cover have that city as the fifth character or whatever it is. Is it fun to just be on the road and just see where the road takes you?
I think so. It does mention cities like Miami and New York and
Jacksonville.
Places along the way, but it's not about where they are. It's more about the journey itself. And so they don't really focus on where they are at any one time. It's not that that fifth character you're talking about, like Sleepless in Seattle, that Seattle's obviously there. And it's just in that space, because a lot of it's just rural. It's not even in the cities for a lot of it. Right. It's how do you get by without having those interactions with people or cities? And I kept thinking about, you know, this type of journey would not be the same today.
No, you can't casually hitchhike.
You would have a lot more easy access to communication. If you lost your wallet, you'd have some way of recouping some funds, and a little bit easier than just, well, you're plumb out of luck, and you know, the cars are more readily accessible. And it has to be in that era. And I don't know where I'm going there.
Well, I like the idea that it kind of has to be in this era for this story as it is to work. And the era is comfortable enough to me that, you know, I think I talk about loving the Coen Brothers movies. I love O Brother, Where Art Thou? And there are some movies where I can really sink into the time period. And I think with this one, it did. It was nice that they weren't in like a horse-drawn carriage, right? Like they're on some things that could be considered modern, like the bus or the yacht, whatever it is. But I kind of felt like that really contributed to the charm. I found this movie really charming. And so the time period did that for me. The style of clothes did that for me. The breaking out into song on the bus did that for me.
Yeah. I get annoyed when people are playing music on their phone, but they've got a whole band in the back and everyone is cool with it.
There was something when she first sits down in his seat, the seat that he had to clear the papers for, where she sits down and then just starts to look out the window like, well, it's a long trip. Time to look out the window the whole time. Right. That I think to myself, how long do I go before fishing my phone out of my shirt pocket to be like, well, let's check the fantasy basketball. And so it is kind of nice to also think about, like, well, you're going to be on a long road trip with the people on this bus. And so you get to know one another, and none of them were particularly savory that we're talking to her, but it all kind of works out. And speaking of it all working out, normally we end our shows with our superlatives. So I'd like to talk more about this movie in that section. You guys ready?
Ready.
Sure.
Sarah, who is the MVP of It Happened One Night?
I think it has to be Clark Gable. I don't know who else you would give it to. I mean, he's that driving force. He's got the good, bad qualities to him. And he's just... he's fit for that part.
He can't pronounce the word wolf.
That is a drawback.
He will not win an award from me. I looked it up because it's a Pittsburgh thing that up here we say wolf.
Wolf.
Drives me nuts. My daughter came home and she from her grade school friends was like, hey, look, a wolf. And let's go to Great Wolf Lodge. I'm like, nope, we are not going to this fun water park until you say wolf. So wolf. So when he's not from Pittsburgh, he was like from somewhere in the Midwest. It was just an interesting thing that they have him sing a song about a word he can't pronounce correctly. But
so that means he's definitely, you know, you're not your MVP because of the way he pronounces a word.
Yes, correct. Yes, I am that petty.
So who is?
He was wonderful, and if you read more 6 years later, Bugs Bunny was actually based on a lot of his mannerisms and Shapley. Shapley uses the word doc. You see Clark Gable eating the carrot, speaking quickly. And so Bugs Bunny, and he actually uses the gangster name of Bugs.
Yeah.
So that's where that came from. But for me, it's Frank Capra. Capra is our director. Mm-hmm. When you win the Big Five awards, you've done something right. I think it's lean. It's well acted. It's a joy to watch. And it's interesting because nobody thought this was a good movie while they were making it. Claudette Colbert says this is the worst movie that you could watch. That was her response. And then when she got nominated, she jumps on a train. She's like, I'm not going to win for this piece of trash. And then she wins and they pull her off the train to attend the ceremony. Clark Gable didn't want to be in it. He was like loaned out from Warner Brothers. The rumor is it was punishment for something he'd done. I can't remember what it was. That's somewhat been debunked, but Capra still insisted he was an unwilling participant in this film. Like, nobody wanted to make this. Nobody liked it or the leads, and yet it's a wonderful, as you put it, charming movie. So
the only thing saving it is that dang whirly bird. So we gotta get to the landing of the plane.
I'm actually going with Bonds Capra. Film.
Oh, there we go. I'm actually going with Capra as well. There is the journey movie, or the stuck together. That's one, the way I look at this. This is a stuck together movie. And I guess as a progenitor of it, or as something where I think romance might not have had the opportunity to be as comedic as we see them today. I was actually describing how I was excited to do this movie with you two tonight, to a coworker today. And I was saying that, like, this doesn't fit rom-com. It's romance that's comedic.
Screwball comedy is what it's labeled as.
Screwball, yeah, okay. I guess that's always hard for me. The old terms, 90-year-old terms. I guess we'll see if they hold up. But I'm gonna go with Capra as well. I thought it was put together well, and hour 45 seemed. I think. What did you say? It was just.
I said it was lean.
That's right. It is lean. Wasn't quite as tight as I generally like it, but it was lean. Sarah, who's your best supporting actor?
I really enjoyed Walter Connolly as Ellie's father. I just felt like Chad was talking about at the beginning, he was mean and almost said, like, here she goes again. Like, he's that father figure, and he's almost not despicable, but annoying. Like, the how a father should be, I guess, maybe sometimes. And
I was fine with him.
And then that turn in the end, when he really looks out for his daughter, and he's the driving force of getting them back together. Without him having that dialogue and remembering who Peter was, you know, that it wouldn't have had the ending. And I felt like Walter Connolly did a really good job with that.
He does have that great scene with Ellie where Ellie's just like, oh, he tells me I'm a brat and that you raised me horribly. He's like, I don't think much of this guy. She's like, oh, he's marvelous. And then having all that information, then still pursues Peter. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Who's your best supporting, Chad?
I went with Charles Wilson as Joe Gordon. I talked about it earlier, and I just like the manicness of his character, the highs and the lows. And then at the end, he goes up to Peter, presumably gives him money. I couldn't see what he slipped in his pocket, but he's like, basically, come talk to me when you sober up. He is a big sucker for love. He is cheering for love.
Yeah, he had reread the story that he threw in the trash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like J. Jonah Jameson with a heart of gold.
Yeah. The editors have a great opportunity to have a lasting impression, just like J. Jonah Jameson does. I think it is money, because he had just returned it to him, saying like, oh, it was a joke, and it's still in his hand, so he just gives it back to him. At least that's what I thought. I think I have to go with Walter Connolly as well, too. We did talk about that sort of redeeming turn at the end. To be able to play unlikable and likable, which is what he does in this movie, is a bit of a feat. And so we do have to lean pretty heavily into it at the end. Like we said, there is the consistency there, which is he just never likes the King Wesley guy. So I thought his performance was really worthy of that Best Supporting. Sarah, what is the hidden gem of It Happened One Night?
This is just something really, really minor, but I felt the last inn that they stayed at, where they were really just going to rip them off and run away as soon as they got up in the morning, there was this couple that I assumed to be the owners. And just the way that the two of them played off each other, he's naive and just
he's rooting for love.
Oh yeah, this is a great couple. And the wife is, you know, oh, they're going to rip us off. And, you know, we shouldn't have given them a room. And just their interaction, I enjoyed listening to them and the back and forth between them. So I kind of found that to be a little hidden gem moment.
Yeah, they were fun. We get small little glimpses from a lot of people. There's very few supporting actors, but there's a lot of small roles, even like as small as like the first bus driver, the oh yeah guy. Like we get a lot of those small roles, and most of them are very funny. Who is your hidden gem, Chad?
Oh yeah, I went with Ward Bond. He is the first bus driver, although I could have awarded it to the second one, who nearly crashes the bus while singing and dancing. The great movie for bus drivers. Well casted, but the oh yeah scenes are so funny. It's hard to make two words consistently funny, and they go to that well like three or four times, and especially when he goes back to that well for Ellie. That's just fantastic. But I like it immediately backfiring on Peter Warren. Okay, now you need the bus driver, and the bus driver's just like, yep, I'm not going to help you get this seat back.
Right. I have something to say on that a little bit later. For me, my hidden gem is there were a couple. I think it's the guy who he describes as the street thief who robs people on the road, the way that he's just belting out that song.
Oh, gosh.
that was my first real laugh out loud moment. Young people in love are very seldom hungry. Like he's just singing this ridiculous thing. And like, okay, Peter says like, all right, that's enough of it. Put a lid in it. He doesn't want me to sing anymore. This is all
so
great.
So I'd spend my honeymoon hitchhiking.
Yeah, this guy's wild. And so I thought like, whoa, this is like, is it count as a big swing? Being loud is funny. And that guy's just singing to his heart's content. I really loved that. My second hidden gem, because I like to break the rules, is I like the way that Ellie bites into that carrot finally. It's very sweet, very cute. I guess I'll have to eat this, which is fine. All right, Sarah, who are you recasting? 1934. who are you recasting?
So I struggle with recasting anyway, so I went to a modern retelling and just recasting our two leads. So I picked as the two lead roles as Chris Hemsworth and Anna Kendrick. I feel like both of them could kind of lean into the playing off of each other. And I feel like they could lean into the jokes and I don't know about chemistry together, but I like both of them.
Yeah.
I feel like Anna Kendrick could manage chemistry with just anybody. About anyone.
Yeah. I think Anna Kendrick can do anything. And I think Sarah just wants to see Hemsworth go over how the undressing sequence goes.
Yes.
This is true.
Wait, I didn't get it. Can you do that again for me?
Right? I would watch it a few times.
Can you show me how the pants would go over the shoes? I know
really
you're a different
me,
man.
I really just need the shirt part.
Yeah.
We joke that I love Thor.
It's not a joke. I understand. I understand. I've accepted this. He's a handsome man.
Who are you recasting then, Chad?
I too, it's just a waste of time for me to recast in the 30s.
How do we do it?
Yeah. I mean, we can, but I can say names that everyone would be like, yep, okay. And no one, none of us actually know the names, or we might know, and we have no strong
feelings. Yeah, sure, yeah.
You mentioned O Brother, Where Art Thou? So I was thinking of George Clooney's character while watching this. Mm-hmm. And so I went with George Clooney, and Anne Hathaway has played a princess, and I think she would make a good heiress in this. So mm-hmm. I went George Clooney and Anne Hathaway in this.
I could see that. I could see. I think I need to squish their ages together a little bit, or I think maybe it is that just Anne Hathaway just will look very, very young for a long time. I think she's older than me.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, for me, I also had the impossible task of trying to figure out somebody from the 30s. Nobody knows.
Vivian Leigh and Humphrey Bogart. There you go.
Yeah, sure. Bela Lugosi as... So I went for bus driver number two, I went Chris Farley. Nice. Because I like him driving the bus. I can see him singing and dancing and crashing the bus in a very funny way.
I can totally see that. That is fantastic.
That was my best shot. Sorry, I guess that was my best shot at the recast. Let's do your best shot at the best shot, Sarah.
So I struggled with this one a little bit. I think I did enjoy the scene where the shot where they were in the hay bales, because it was very dark. Mm-hmm. You know, you could tell it was at night, and trying to still be able to see what needed to be seen, but you know, in that time, lighting and stuff, I don't think was quite as advanced as it is now. And you could still see what you need to see, but have some mystery to it as well. And so I enjoyed that part of it.
That was a pretty scene. Yeah. And I think it almost made you think, if it were not at night, it's like, is that background painted? Like there was something about that was a little magical.
What and with your the best black shot? And white and... Yeah.
Yeah, that helped it too, right? Because sometimes I with my eyes, I try to find the color in black and white stuff, because you know that the colors are kind of wild when you go back and look, or when you hear the stories of how things are colored in order to stand out differently in black and white film. But it does seem that scene was actually almost my pick. Chad, what's your best shot?
I went with the shot in the cabin of Peter telling Ellie everything he wants, and you see her reactions, and you've got the walls of Jericho separating them.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it. It's a tender, it's a sweet moment, and it's a well-framed shot.
And it's over the top from her, of just how like, oh my goodness, that he's really touching my heart with the things he's saying, but it didn't feel like too much. It felt like she's has a chance to let her heart respond to this stuff, and it was... I thought it was really beautiful as well. My best shot is actually the piggyback argument shot while they're crossing the creek.
Nice.
Because it is sort of, it's physically difficult, but you have the beautiful rippling water behind them, and it's while the sun is directly over it. So you can, and they are essentially in silhouette while this is happening. And, you know, she's like knocking his shoes against his backside. He's like, "Will you stop being silly?" And you know, then he gives her a little swat afterwards, and that's kind of fun. But the idea is that was a beautiful shot that was sort of juxtaposed with the humor of that argument about piggybacking. So I thought that was really good. What is your best scene of this movie, Sarah?
We've talked about it a lot. I have to go with the flying trapeze scene.
Oh wow!
Just the way that they all interact and the novelty of the just spontaneity of the scene, and just everybody on the bus is having a good time, and I just love that. So
yeah, that was the same with mine too.
Cool.
There's no music. We didn't talk about this, but there's no music in this movie. There's like no soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So this is the bright spot. 1930s could overdo it. You know, we covered a movie from the 40s last week where they would put music in inappropriate spots just to have music. So the sluice gate had opened for the gold. There's this ominous, like, fires of Mount Doom music, and it's just water running down. We're like, okay, chill out with that. This, nothing's happening. You're getting us excited for no good reason. This movie just lets the talking do it for us. But to Sarah's point, everyone's having such a good time. There's smiles on everybody's face, and I can't help smiling at stupid song.
Yeah.
That I had no idea had verses, but now I do.
Yeah. And I think that's also something that we all knew that was a song, right? Like you, Chad, you knew it, Sarah, you knew it.
Oh yeah.
I knew it was a song, but I think I had heard it in like The Simpsons or something. I had heard that song and like that melody is with me. The melody that I know is a little different than that one, but I knew some of the words. It was kind of neat to hear that. Like, oh, we're all just having a great time. For me, my best scene was the first night in the cabin where they're just getting used to each other a little bit. Clark Gable's character, Peter, is doing most of the talking. It is during the undressing scene. He is talking about the walls of Jericho. He is saying he's going to let her borrow the pajamas. Like, he has gone through a lot to try to protect her. And we do know that it is because he wants the story. But he's being, like, way more respectful than you would think. And just the effort that he goes to in the morning as well is something that's just, it was unexpected to me. I don't know what it is. Like I said, I don't know Clark Gable from any actor from the 30s, but I was expecting him to not be that. I wasn't expecting him to be like kind of stand up good guy in this way. It really threw me for a loop. And I thought that scene was pretty fun.
He's rough, but tender.
Yeah. Sarah, what's your best wardrobe or makeup moment?
Only wardrobe or makeup moment I could really think about was the Walls of Jericho and the undressing, and I still can't get over the shoes thing.
I can tell.
it bothers me.
But you know what? That was revolutionary. This almost sunk the undershirt industry because Clark Gable is not wearing an undershirt. He is going bare-chested, and this started a trend of men going bare-chested. So that is an excellent pick, and it is mine also because it changed an industry.
I promise you we didn't look at each other's ahead of time.
We didn't. She likes hunky bare-chested men and confusing pants rituals.
And so does Chad, and we all know.
I like historical industry-changing bare-chested moments.
Oh, man. When you said industry changing, it made me think of that moment in Aliens when he's got his collar flipped up.
Oh,
it's like, oh, now we know we're in the future because his suit jacket collar is it's ridiculous. So for me, it was Claudette Colburn's eyebrows are wild, thin, and shaped like a doll's. Strange. And when I first saw them, I'm like, weird. But as the movie goes on, and she's got this almost porcelain face, the eyebrows grew on me. And I'm like, this really works for her. Can't say I've ever seen her in anything else. Don't know if it was unique to this movie. But I will say that her eyebrows really worked for me. And because they started off really weird for me. So that was pretty good on that choice, because you don't see anybody with eyebrows like that anymore.
Well, she got a deal. She turned down the movie and they got so desperate, like Betty Davis wouldn't do it. And so she said, I'll come back for double my salary. So she got like 50 grand in back then.
Wow.
Good for her.
Yeah.
All right. We have to change one thing. Sarah, what are you changing?
My one thing would be the way that Oscar Shapley was treated at the end. Well,
yeah, that got to you.
But like when he made his exit, because I mentioned it earlier, I just don't like the fact that he went after his children, and like, couldn't there have been another way to just get rid of the guy instead of like make him terrified for his life, like in his livelihood? Like I struggle when people are just picked on unnecessarily. It bothers me.
She's staring at me because I was picked on unnecessarily.
No.
Yes.
That's not why.
Well, you would not have been an annoying person on the road. Like you know, fun on the side, Shapely. There's nothing about you that's like that. Like, I'm not saying the guy deserved it, right? But he didn't get physically beaten up. He didn't get shot in the back. He just got scared by him. That seemed like a streetwise trick more than a real threat, but I'm not taking that away.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
You want the annoying guy treated with more grace. Like,
yeah,
hey,
like I
don't tell anyone. But yeah, he wants the money. So he's got to really make sure he doesn't blab, I guess.
But like, to me, he's been running away and they're running away as well. why not just somehow make it so that he goes back to that bus, Shapley goes back to the bus, and they go run away, and at least one of them has a vehicle.
I will say Shapley is a scumbag, though, because he was married, and he's immediately hitting on Ellie.
So and he's known with his friends to do that. Like, he's a guy that does that. Yeah. He is a scumbag. I actually thought they might run into Shapley on the road.
I did too, yeah.
I was kind of hoping that they would, actually. That wasn't my change one thing, though. Chad, what's yours?
I mentioned it earlier, but let's get a little less domestic violence-y when it comes to the speech to the father. Like, you could phrase it in a way of, if she's really lucky, she'll meet a man that wants to strangle her or something. Like, said in a way where it's less like, I can never imagine saying to anyone, hey, I hope they wind up with somebody that hits them every day, whether they deserve it or not. Like, I'm sure that was a turn of phrase or whatever. Like, the same way I'm saying, makes me want to strangle.
Right.
But to modern ears, it doesn't sit right.
I see what you mean. And you can, it's funny. I'm not a huge fan of the show or anything, but they normalized Homer Simpson strangling his son. And it was funny.
That's although they changed that.
I heard they changed it, but I don't really watch the show. It's just that's one of those things. It's like it's kind of weird.
Well, it's later on, but I think of the show The Honeymooners, where the catchphrase is "One of these days, I will straight to the
straight
moon."
Straight to the moon,
and the implication is I'm going to hit her somewhere. And that was the punchline of the show, and everyone was fine with it. So I mean, it's clearly a different era and a different type of language. I don't think you actually believe Ralph is going to hit her.
Right.
I hope not, but it's weird that we made being him in a punchline.
It is weird. Yeah.
I think he was trying to just convey like that you not that you hate somebody so much you love them, but like
That they're infuriating.
Right. Yeah. You know? Well, that's the point, I think, is that's when you can say to somebody that, like, I wouldn't be getting this upset if I didn't care about you. You're driving me crazy because I care about you so dang much.
Yeah.
And that is why that it's a strange roundabout way of saying how much like your behavior is endearing to me is that you are driving me crazy. So I get it. And I get that it is weird. For me, I've got one, we haven't brought it up at all. My change one thing is I think that Claudette Colbert needs a voice coach. Did you notice that her affectations change throughout the entire movie? If there is a little bit of a highbrow about culture type of speech, but then there's also kind of like a sweet little Southern girl or a farm girl speech as well. If you do rewatch this movie, she changes between these two, and it does make me think as if, is it intentional, as if like, oh, this is how the upper crust talks, and then, oh, this is how I really talk. And if it's intentional that these differences of how she's putting on an affectation, and then when she's being real with Peter. The thing is, it wasn't ever addressed, and it wasn't clear enough for me to try to get it as a metaphor. So it just sounded as if she's talking two different ways and it is driving me crazy. Because that's another thing about me. I cannot stand a fake Southern accent so when things go off like that, I was like, this is weird. Actually affected my star rating too. Wow. What is your best quote, Sarah?
One of the things we haven't really talked about too much, we've talked about the walls of Jericho at the beginning, but we haven't really talked about them tumbling down. I enjoyed the quotes at the end where Peter says, "What's holding up the annulment? You slowpoke, the walls of Jericho are toppling." And then Alexander says, "Send them a telegram right away. Let's just say, let them topple." And shortly after, you're hearing the trumpet.
Mm-hmm. You were not hearing a trumpet. You were hearing a harmonica.
Regardless, when the scene from the beginning came in, all I could think about was the song that I grew up hearing as a kid, talking about the walls of Jericho.
Joshua hit the walls of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho.
Joshua hit the battle of Jericho.
Oh,
but,
and the walls came tumbling.
And just always hearing about the trumpets and circling the city. And so I don't know if that's something that people would relate to quite as much now, but I totally understood where they were looking for a trumpet and needing to tumble down those walls, because that was something that was so reinforced growing up as a kid in Sunday school. So I would just always hear that. And so that wink and nod was good to, I enjoyed
exactly
that.
Yeah, that wink and nod was kind of a really perfect end to this.
Yeah,
great quote choice. Chad, what's your best quote?
I too went with the dad starting, it's in the middle of his interrogation of Peter, and he's really getting to the point. He says, I ask you a simple question. Do you love her? And Peter responds, yes, but don't hold that against me. I'm a little screwy myself.
Yeah.
As he had just mentioned before, like anyone that would love her would have to be crazy. And then he finally admits, I do. And I'm a little screwy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a real big payoff, I think, is that she tells him that she loves him. He says, get back to your side. Boy, yeah. Unexpected. And so then it's way later that he says to her dad, yeah, I love her. That's very sweet, 90 years later even. for me, that quote that you mentioned before, that weird thing he says, she says, who are you? He goes, I'm the whippoorwill that cries in the night. I'm the soft morning breeze that caresses your lovely face. Yeah, but you got a name? Like to me, I also thought that was weird, and it was almost my number one quote, but we get my number one quote from Shapley later, which is something that it's almost, it's not Cockney rhyming slang, but it's almost slang level, where like you could not explain it to somebody nowadays, which is he's describing how... like how the situation with Ellie running away from, the fortune, like the rich dad. And he says something like, a bird that figures that way always ends up behind the eight ball. What a phrase that truly you could not explain to anybody nowadays. And so I think I'm going to try to put that into my lexicon. I'm going to start trying to say that. If there's somebody that I know that like I'm trying to give a mysterious slight, as I'm trying to say, then I'm going to tell them that a bird that figures that way, a bird like that is going to end up behind the eight ball. So yeah, adding that to my vocabulary. Well, we have come for full circle here. So Sarah, what is your rating of this movie? I'll remind you, a half star is the lowest we could give. A 5-star is the highest we give. And this is on a 0.5 scale. So how many stars?
I would give it 4. It's a solid movie, enjoyable. I don't really have much else to say. I enjoyed it. I really had a good time. I'm just not one to go extremes, and generally speaking.
This is true. This is true. I've had a weird... Her family has a weird assertion. They're all German, so I think the last time when Germans showed extreme emotions, Poland got invaded. So they are...
Boy, talk about twists.
So I'm like, name your favorite movie. And they all just stared and they said, we can't. I'm like, what do you mean you can't? It's like, name your favorite book. And they're like, well, my favorite book may change.
Depends on the genre. Depends on the day.
Commit to something. Have a favorite. Yeah. I will be extreme though. 5 stars for me. This is a 5-star movie. I loved it. This is my second romantic comedy of the year, so I may have been put in this mood from When Harry Met Sally. That was close. That was a 4.5 for me. I'm just having a great time with these, and I really highly value a movie that can make me laugh, and this movie made me laugh. I watched it twice. I will revisit it again. I had such a good time.
Wow, great score. And I'm actually going to mirror Sarah here. I'm going to give it a 4. I had only the negative I could really say was the thing about Ellie's voice. Aside from that, it is a fun romp, all the vignettes in a row. To call it screwball, whatever, the terms of the era don't make sense to me. But but it is, I think rom-com is such a genre that it's like a label attached to things. And Chad, I know you sometimes mention things like, oh, that's not horror adjacent, that's horror, or one way around. And where it's like, well, this is it rom-com? It's hard to say. It really does feel like it is more romance. It's like the difference between romance and passion. Like there's certain things that the word almost doesn't make sense. And so like this is almost just like a drama that is funny, or an adventure, which is what this is, an adventure along the Eastern Seaboard that just happens to include, you know, romantic love. But it did rate high for me, which is a 4. And I would say that if someone brought up movies, or if I'm looking for something on like a date night, this is something I'd love to surprise a partner with. Like, hey, it happened one night. You want to watch a 90-year-old movie? Shut up. We're going to watch it. Why I oughta. All right. So good scores all around. But we need to pick something for next time. Chad, can you help me?
Yes, we love a good villain song here at the Roundtable. Oh, yeah. Our selections for next week are some of the best villain songs of all time. So option number one, The Little Mermaid from 1989, Poor Unfortunate Soul. A mermaid princess makes a Faustian bargain in an attempt to become human and win a princess' love. Are we going to use the word Faustian anymore? Like, that doesn't... That seems no longer relevant.
Just you.
But I love it. IMDb description. Option two, 101 Dalmatians from 1961, Cruella de Vil.
Oh, it's so good.
When a litter of Dalmatian puppies are abducted by the minions of Cruella de Vil, the owners must find them before she uses them for a diabolical fashion statement. Love that description too.
That's good.
And option three, The Hunchback of Notre Dame from 1996. We've got Hellfire. A deformed bell ringer must assert his independence from a vicious government minister in order to help his friend, a gypsy dancer.
Wow. Okay. Tough decision here. Gosh. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Minister Frollo, as a villain, and the song. You got me with that one. Yeah, we have to go with Hunchback of Notre Dame, 96.
Excellent, excellent. We'll be talking some Hellfire next week.
Choose me or your pyre, be mine or you will burn, he said. Wow, well, thank you, Sarah.
I'm equipped with that.
No problem.
And thank you, Chad. It's always great to chat rom-com with you. That is now your main genre.
Fair enough.
And thank you, all the lords, ladies, and knights of the Retro Movie Roundtable. We invite you to reach out to us. We want to hear from you. Subscribe, rate, and review to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Give us a like on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at movie_retro. Email us at retromovieroundtable@yahoo.com. Producing and providing this podcast is fun, but not free. We invite you to support the show at our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/retromovieroundtable. Any contribution is much appreciated and will go towards making the show better for you, the listeners.
And shout out to Michael Wilder for our most recent Patreon contributions.
Big shout out to Michael Wilder. Thank you, sir. I know somebody with that last name. Pretty cool cat. A bird that was not going to end up behind the eight ball. As always, thank you for listening. Be good to each other and watch more movies. Chad?
I've got 24 hours to get rid of this bozo, or the entire scheme I've been setting up for 18 years goes up in smoke, and you are wearing his merchandise?